marriages are made in heaven, but all the details have to be worked out on earth. Which is to say, sometimes when you get married, you think you got it all together until you get married, then you realize you got to work out all the details. Some of you guys just got back from Alaska, and they tell us that marriage is like two porcupines in Alaska. The coldness drives you together, but your points drive you apart. And so sometimes marriage is like that. You just can't wait to get together, and as soon as you get together, you start to struggle. We've been studying the book of Song of Songs, and I'll just throw up here some verses and so that we'd like to say together. Would you repeat them with me? I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. Many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. If a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised. I trust that last verse is what dominates your marriage relationship. Let's go to the outline of the book. As you know, it talks about falling in love. We studied that. United in love. We studied that. Tonight we're going to be struggling in love. Next week, continuing in love. As you talked about falling in love, the next slide will show you. We saw there was a mutual attraction, a mutual adoration, a mutual affection. There's a progression there and mutual abstinence. When we are united in love, there's a time of commitment, time of celebration, and time of consummation, which we studied last week. But tonight we're going to chapter 5 and chapter 6. And they're married. Everything seems to be going well until they get through the honeymoon and something goes wrong. And so we'd like to read it again. Again, I'd like to program your mind. It is, to me, the Bible is very simple to understand if you just read it. And if you don't try to make it sophisticated, don't try to make it complicated, don't try to make it say what it doesn't say. If it talks about a tree, it probably is talking about a tree. Don't try to make it think there's some kind of poetic, flowery language for some kind of erotic event in the life of an individual. Just, it's talking about a tree, you know? And whatever it's talking about, just read it. And when you read this, it's just about as simple as you can get. Chapter 5 and chapter 6, just a husband and wife have a fight. Now, you can't relate to that. That's the wonderful thing about it. You've never gone through it. You've never experienced this. I understand that. But we're just going to go into a hypothetical world that happens to some people that you might even know. And it starts all on a deacon's meeting night. Can you imagine that? A deacon's meeting went late. And the deacon comes home and the fight got started. Now, some of you are laughing like you are either a deacon or a deacon's wife because you've been there. So let's read it. Song of Songs, chapter 5. It's going to be a mutual interaction back and forth. And she's going to talk, then he's going to talk. Then the daughters of Jerusalem step back and take a look at it. Sometimes you need outside people to help you to see what you're not seeing. That's the value of the daughters of Jerusalem. They are the outside people who are saying to her, young lady, don't you get it? And then they talk to him. Don't you get it? And often we do need outside people to help us to see what we just don't see. So let's read it. Chapter 5, verse 2. We're going to start with a lady. You can relate. I sleep, but my heart is awake. It is the voice of my beloved. He knocks, saying, open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is covered with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. I've taken off my robe. How can I put it on again? I've washed my feet. How can I defile them? My beloved put his hand by the latch of the door, and my heart yearned for him. I arose to open for my beloved, and my heart dripped with the myrrh. My fingers would lick at liquid myrrh on the handles of the lock. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone. My heart leaped up when he spoke. I sought him, but I couldn't find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. The watchman went who went about the city found me. They struck me. They wounded me. The keepers of the walls took my veil away from me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him, I am lovesick. What is your beloved more than another beloved, O fairest among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved, that you would charge us such? Ah, my beloved is white. He's ruddy. He's the chief among 10,000. His head is like the finest goat. His locks are wavy and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves by the rivers of water, washed with milk and fitly set. His cheeks are like a bed of spices, banks of scented herbs. His lips are lilies dripping with liquid myrrh. His hands are rods of gold set with beryl. His body is carved ivory inlaid with sapphires. His legs are pillars of marble set on bases of fine gold. His countenance is like Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. Yes, he's altogether lovely. That's my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Well, where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Where has your beloved turned aside, that we may seek after him with you? My beloved has gone to his garden, to the bed of spices, to feed his flock in the gardens, to gather lilies. I am my beloved's. My beloved is mine. He feeds his flock amongst the lilies. Oh, my love, you are as beautiful as Tirzah, lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners. Turn your eyes away from me, for they have overcome me. Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep which have come up from washing. Everyone bears twins, and none is barren among them. Like a piece of pomegranate are your temples behind your veil. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her. The daughters saw her and called her blessed, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her. Who is she who looks forth at the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, awesome as an army with banners? I went down to the garden for nuts, to see the verdure of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded and the pomegranates had bloomed. Before I was even aware, my soul had made me as the chariots of my noble people. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you. Why would you want to see me? As it were, the dance of the two camps. I trust tonight you caught that. It is very, very simple, is it not? It's like reading what happens to you as husband and wife whenever there's a struggle. And tonight we want to understand that. Let's pray. Father, help us to just appreciate that you would take the time to allow us to walk into a very small fight between a man and a woman, something very minor, and yet it caused a division that could have gotten bigger. It could have got blown out of proportion, except they were a people who took the right steps to maintain their marriage and deal with the struggles in it. Well, thank you for that, for we prayed in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, did you figure out what the fight was all about? When you read about it, it's like really silly. But that's what fights are all about. They're always about something really silly. Verse 2 tells you the problem. And she says, I sleep, but my heart is awake. It's the voice of my beloved. He knocks, saying, open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. My head is covered with dew. He's just come home late from a deacon's meeting. Some reason he's been out a long, long time, and the dew of the morning is already covering his head. Maybe he's been out hunting. Maybe he's been out fishing. Maybe he's been to a deacon's meeting. I don't know what it is, but for whatever reason, he just comes home late. And you have to understand the culture of that day. They had bedchambers, and in many cultures, even in our day, when you get married, you give your wife a special room, a bedchamber. And that's her room. And that room she can lock, and it's her special place. And so when you come as the man to your wife's room, it's her room. It's not your room. It's not our bedroom. It's her bedroom. And you knock, and she has a lock on it. And he says, you know, I came home late one night, and boy, I was just thinking about my dove, my love, my perfect one. And I knocked on the door and said, I'm here. Arise, awake. And you ladies are smiling. And what are you thinking when you are already tucked in bed? Here's what she says. I've taken off my robe. I'm snuggly in bed. How can I put it on again? I've washed my feet. How can I defile them? She says, you're asking a lot, man. You guys stay out late hunting and whatever it is, and I'm all tucked in bed, and I've got my feet all washed, and I'm all snuggled in something nice and warm, and then you expect me to wake up in the middle of the night and go open the door for you and let you in. Good luck, buddy. Now I'm going to take a vote tonight. Who may think the woman here is right? I mean, this guy's asking an unreasonable thing. I mean, if he wants to stay out late, that's his problem. But don't come knocking on my door when you've done your thing. How many of you think that the woman is right? How many think the man's right? I mean, I'm only asking a little thing. Just get out of bed when you're nice and snuggled warm. Just because I stayed out late, you at least should come and get me. I think you're my love, my dove, my beloved. How many think the man's right? Oh, all the guys think that. You know, when you read it, we just laugh about it. What a little silly thing, right? And that's exactly what God wants you to see. This is a little silly thing. That's how fights start. Little silly things. Things that we'd laugh about. Things that you say, what's the big deal? But it starts there. And there's something going on. And the conflict has started. What you sense as you read through this is that you'll find it difficult to say, here's a woman who said she really, really loved him when she got married, and now she is unwilling to get out of bed to open the door for him. Earlier, she said, there ain't no mountain high enough. There ain't no valley wide enough to keep me from getting to you. I mean, she said, you are more important to me than anything. Now she won't even get out of bed because her feet are clean. You know who she's thinking about? She is thinking about herself. And he comes with this request in the middle of the night. And who's he thinking about? He's thinking about himself. And suddenly a man is thinking about himself and a woman's thinking about herself, and a silly little fight starts. But they take care of it and they deal with it. And tonight, as we study the next verses, I'd like to just point out some principles of how to have a good fight and how to take care of silly little fights that might enter into your marriage when the man seems unreasonable or the woman sees unreasonable, as they both forget about what they once thought about their spouse and now they're thinking of themselves. First of all, verse 4 and 5. Chapter 5. My beloved put his hand by the latch of the door. My heart yearned for him. I rose to open for my beloved. In other words, he said, please open for me. She said, I can't get out of bed and I just got clean feet. How in the world could I possibly get dirty feet again? And all of a sudden she says, you know, I heard his hand at the latch and it sparked my heart to yearn again. And so she jumps out of bed. She who had said, no, I'm not getting out of bed, suddenly is ready to get out of bed and runs to the door to open it to him. However, here's what's already true. Verse 4. My beloved had put his hand to the door. My heart yearned for him. I rose to open for my beloved. My hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the lock. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone away. Here's what happened. She says, I'm sorry, can't get out of bed. And you know what he did? He broke down the door. Right? He yelled at her. Said, what kind of a lady are you? When I married you, you said anything would go. Now you won't even get up and open the door, right? Absolutely not. He knew that he was asking something that was really quite unreasonable. And so on the latch of the door, he put a bundle of myrrh and he walked away. He did not retaliate and he didn't push and he didn't shove and he didn't rush and he didn't say, these are my rights. I'm the man of the house. Watch out, lady. He put Chanel number 5 on the door latch and said, she'll wake up sooner or later. She'll know that I love her. She is my love. She's my flawless one. She is my beloved. She's my little dove. Rule number 1, be very reasonable in your expectations of your mate. And when your mate says, I'm snuggled in bed and I got nice clean feet, you do not retaliate. You do not shove and you do not push. You do not say, this is my right. Here I am. You don't run off mad. You don't say, well, I'll get even with you. You leave Chanel number 5 on the door latch and say, when you wake up, you're going to find this. My first suggestion is this. We need to be reasonable. We don't rush. We don't retaliate. We allow the individual, even if they're wrong, the luxury of what they are doing at this time, with no retaliation whatsoever in our lives. One of the first principles that I speak of when I speak to young couples in a premarital counseling situation is 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Many of you have read that many, many times. And as you read 1 Corinthians chapter 7, you recognize the whole principle of 1 Corinthians chapter 7 is this. Marriage is a mutual relationship of ministry to one another. Nobody has the rights in a marriage. You do not have a right or authority over your own body. You do not have rights and authority over your spouse's body. You don't have rights and authority in the other person's lives. And when we finally get it and we have two people who accept the reality that mutually we have no rights over each other and we have no responsibility in their lives, but only in our lives to minister, not to manipulate, to help and not to hurt. What a wonderful thing it is. Rule number 1, be reasonable. Your wife said, I'm tired, I'm snuggled and I'm clean. I don't want to get out of bed. Leave some Chanel number 5. And do not rush or retaliate. Now you understand as you read verse 5 and 6 that something's already happening in her life. So we come to the second principle. Her heart is yearning. She's laying there in bed and says, boy, that was kind of tough on him. You know, I really do like the guy. And all he did was ask me to get out of bed and go open the door. And so she runs to the door. And now she puts her hand on the latch and she hits the Chanel number 5. And it's dripping from her fingers. And boy, she can't wait to see him. I know he's on the other side of the door. And so here's what she does. I open for my beloved, verse 6. But my beloved had turned away and was gone. My heart leaped up when he spoke. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. You know what she did? Principle number 2. Not only are we supposed to be reasonable, we're supposed to be reaching. She all of a sudden recognized how valuable he was, how much she loved him, how much yearning was in her heart for him. And she took the initiative to go to find him. And she took the initiative to open the door and go after him. Here's some things that are true as you read through them. Verse 6, I sought him. I couldn't find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. She took the initiative to say, we can't let this one go tonight. She took the initiative to make sure that somehow she would go out and find him and call him and bring this to reconciliation. Fights will go on if somebody doesn't take the initiative to go. Fights will get worse. They'll just expand if somebody doesn't take the initiative to say, I have to get out of bed, I have to go find, I have to go call, I have to go do the work. And she did. She takes the initiative. Not only that, verse 7 says, the watchmen who went about the city found me. They struck me. They wounded me. The keepers of the walls, they took my veil away from me. We've been familiar with that because early on she had dreamt about that in chapter 3, I believe it was, where she had dreamt about all that. What we recognize is she is taking the initiative and she is doing that at any cost. For a woman to go out into the city this time of night, she was automatically assumed to be a prostitute. That was just a given. And so the watchmen beat up on her. The watchmen ripped the veil off her face. She is reaching out to him and she is willing to take the initiative. She is willing to pay the price to find him. She is willing to go look for him. She is willing to be held with contempt and shame by other people who don't understand what she is doing because she is reaching for him. And a fight will go on unless somebody is willing to take the initiative and somebody is willing to pay a price. To look stupid, maybe, to be held with contempt, perhaps, to take some physical abuse, perhaps. Somebody's got to take the initiative, and somebody has to pay the price. And then you read in verse 8, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him, I am lovesick. She is willing to talk to all the people around her and say, I need help. You know why we often have fights that just keep getting worse and worse? We're too proud to ask for help. We're too proud to say to the people around us, please help me through this problem. My beloved and I are having a little bit of a spiff here. And we're hiding behind our nice little smiles as we all watch each other. And everything's going well. When in reality, we should be saying, would you please help me? I'm having a difficulty in my life. The principle is this. Make sure that you are reasonable in your expectations, but make sure you are reaching, willing to take the initiative, willing to pay a price, willing to ask for help from others around you who might be able to somehow bring you together and get this all mended while it's still a silly little fight. You know what our problems are? We're all like this, whether it's in marriage problems or financial problems or any other kinds of problems. We're just too proud. Raising kids, we let our kids get worse and worse and worse and worse and worse before we go ask somebody to help us in the raising of our kids. Why don't we ask somebody for help when it's a small problem? Financial problem, we have a little bit of a financial problem. We don't ask anybody for help until we get deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper in financial problems until we're so far buried we finally go ask for help. And what can anybody do at that point? You're too buried. We have marriage problems and we have little problems. We just have little problems that we can't get overcome somehow on our own. But rather than cry for help, we let it get worse and worse and worse until finally we go ask for help when the problem is so big that who possibly could solve your problems now? This is a silly little problem that somebody has to reach. Take the initiative, pay the price, and ask for help. She swallowed humble pie and she walked through the city to get him back. That leads to principle number 3. When you read in verse 9, the daughters of Jerusalem come in. And as you know, in this account, if you could have this drama acted out in front of you, the daughters of Jerusalem are the outsiders in a sense. They are the ones who are kind of watching what's going on. And they have that role to somehow see things from a different perspective and express things from a different perspective because the man and the woman are either googly-eyed and aren't thinking that way or they're mad at each other, they're not thinking that way. And somebody stands back and just looks at the reality and says, why are you doing this? What is this all about? And asks some very legitimate questions. The first question they ask in verse 9 is this, what is your beloved more than another beloved? You asked me to go help find your husband? What's so special about him? Why in the world would you go looking after that guy? Why is he any better than any other beloved? Is he worth it? In fact, this is what they say in verse 9. O fairest among women, what is your beloved more than another beloved that you so charge us? What is so special about him? Is he really worth it? And you know, that was a great question. What is so special about your spouse? What really is so special about this relationship that you would try to keep it going, that you would do the work that it takes to make sure it works? What is so special about this? You can almost hear them saying it in a, maybe even a sarcastic tone. What's so special about him? Just let him go. You can find another guy. You're the fairest among women. And you know what happens? All of us, and she is answering that question in her mind. What is so special about him? My wife many years ago read an article about divorce. It was in a secular magazine. You know what most people do when they separate and divorce? They add up all the advantages of getting rid of their spouse. Oh, it's going to be great. I don't have to do this. I won't have to do this. And they think of all the advantages of separation and divorce. And the secular magazine was wise enough to say, you know what they don't do? They don't add up all the cost. They don't add up all the things that they are giving up. And if they would take the time to add up all the things that they are giving up, that they are losing, that it is costing them, they might recognize that this far outweighs this. And so now she is forced to think, is he worth it? What is he like? Why would I go out of my way? And so principle number three is this, be remembering. You be remembering. Here's what she does in verse 10. My beloved is white and ruddy. He's chief among 10,000. We have read this from verse 10 down through verse 16. And she starts at the top of his head and goes to the bottom of his feet. We've done that before. We did it when they were dating. We did it when they were married. Now we're doing it later on in their struggle. And you recognize as you read these lists, there's about four or five times in the book of Song of Songs, the man describes the woman or the woman describes the man. And as you read these lists, they're almost always the same. That's very significant. When they are dating, they saw each other a certain way. When they got married, they saw themselves the same way. While they are struggling in love, suddenly somebody draws their attention to it and they see each other like they really should see each other, and nothing has changed. He is still tall, dark, and handsome. He is still the greatest of the greatest. He is still altogether lovely. You can read through that account from top of the head to bottom of feet. And she says, you know what? Verse 16. He's altogether lovely. This is my beloved. This is my friend. I have a tall, dark, handsome, best of the best friend in my life. You ask me why, I would ask you to help me solve my problem in my marriage. Because I know that I have the best of the best. I know it's worth everything to save this marriage. I know that it's worth everything to restore us after this conflict in our lives. And I'm willing to eat humble pie and ask you to help me to make sure that this one goes on. Principle number three is you got to keep remembering. Do not forget the positive aspects of this individual. She could have focused in on, what a jerk to come home late, ask me to get out of bed. She could have done all kinds of crazy things and made that worse and worse, but she doesn't now. She remembers, I have the cream of the crop. I have the same guy I married. I have the same guy I was dating. I have the same guy that I thought was the best of the best. And he still is all of that. Principle number three, you keep remembering and do not forget all the positive things that you have in this relationship. Which leads us to question number two by the daughters of Jerusalem. In chapter 6 and verse 1, they say, where is your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Where is your beloved turned aside that we may seek him with you? Now, this could be taken as just a legitimate question. Please help us to know where to look. But it could be taken with a little bit of a sarcastic tone. Well, where is he? I mean, he's such a great guy. And he loves you and you love him. Where in the world is he? Why'd this guy take off? Where'd he run to? Whether you take it in a straightforward matter or a sarcastic matter, it's a legitimate question. Where is he? Imagine all the answers you could have if you were mad at your spouse. That jerk. For I bet you he's... You could have all kinds of negative, critical statements when people say, where is he? He's a real jerk. He's doing this, this, and I bet you he's, but that is not her tone. And that is not her statement. When they ask, where is he? She gives a very confident, positive, non-critical expression. She says this in verse 2. My beloved has gone to his garden, to the bed of spices, to feed his flock in the gardens, to gather lilies. I am my beloved's. My beloved is mine. He feeds his flock among the lilies. You see, there might have been a little tinge in their question. Where'd he go? He go find another woman? He go find his buddies to go hunting with? What'd he do? She says, you know what he did? I'm very confident, and she doesn't know this yet, but she is very confident that he's just going about business as usual. He's down at his garden. He's taking care of his flocks. He's doing what he's supposed to do. He came in really late in the night, really early in the morning, if you would. When I said, no, I'm not getting out of bed, he left some Chanel No. 5 in the door, and he went about his business. He is not chasing after other women. He is not doing something wrong. He is not out with his buddies and just carousing right now. He is going about his business. And I am confident of this, she says in verse 3. I am my beloved's. My beloved is mine. That's the second time you'll find this in this book. She has a bedrock confidence that their love for each other is solid and sure. She has never challenged or questioned that he loves her and that she loves him. She has never challenged and he has never challenged that their love for each other is a commitment that is strong and true and solid. It is a wonderful thing to have a relationship where you never, ever question the validity and the loyalty of the love for one another. You never, ever question whether you are his beloved and she is yours. That in the midst even of struggles, when you don't even know where they are, you are totally confident they're doing the right thing right now, and they are totally committed and loyal to you. Principle number 4 is this: be respecting. Do not doubt his loyalty. Do not doubt his commitment to you and his love for you. And do not doubt what he is about and where he's going. And the opportunity to say, I think he's a jerk and he's doing all kinds of wrong things. She had a bedrock confidence that my husband is not like that. Oh, we had a little spat here, but I'm his and he's mine. And I know he's just doing business until I come back and find him. Let's go on to principle number 5. When you read down in verse 4, you recognize that the beloved comes in. So the beloved started, then the Shulamite interacted with herself and then with the daughters of Jerusalem through some questions, and they have gone out to find him. And eventually they find him. And after this conflict, this little struggle, this little silly little fight that they had, when they finally see each other and she sees him and he sees her, what are you going to say? Especially, what is he going to say? What do you say to your spouse when finally you got to look each other in the eye? You got to face each other. You got to come to grips with the reality of what went on in your life in the last hours of their life. And he steps in. And when she finds him, he makes it extremely easy for her. He does not say negative things. He doesn't say, well, why'd you come find me now? You wouldn't open the door the other night. He made it extremely easy for this all to be reconciled, for this all to go over. In fact, this is often called in chapter 6, verse 4, down through chapter 6, verse 10, a curious response. And I don't think it's curious when you recognize the depth of their love, but it is curious to the world why anybody would ever respond like this. He sees her coming, and he says this: oh, my love, you are beautiful as Tirzah. You are lovely as Jerusalem. You are awesome as an army with banners. Turn your eyes away from me, for they have overcome me. Your hair is like a flock of goats coming down from Gilead. You know what he says? He is saying the same thing he said before. He is saying, I reinstate and I reconfirm to you that I think you're the best of the best. You are altogether lovely to me as well. Tirzah, of course, was one of the grandest cities in the north. Jerusalem was the grandest city in the south, at least in the Jewish mind. And he says, you know what? You're indescribably beautiful. You're irresistibly beautiful. You're like an army that's irresistible in its movements. You will never move from my perspective of the one that I love. And what he does for her in verses 4 through 7 is restates that he is still infatuated with her. Ah, you are so lovely. I can't believe it. Irresistibly so in my life. The principle is this: we have to be reassuring at those moments. She took the initiative. She went to find him. She went on a limb, cried for help. And when she saw him, it was his opportunity to say something back. He could have been tough on her. He could have said, well, it's about time you got here. Could have said, I don't know why you're here. But he says, you know what? I want to reconfirm that I am still infatuated with you. You're indescribably beautiful to me. But beyond that, he says this in verse 8, 9, and 10. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one. The only one of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her, the daughters who saw her and called her blessed. The queens and the concubines, they have praised her. He said, amongst all the women, you're the best of the best. I want to reassure you, he says, as she comes to him, that I am still infatuated with you. I want to reassure you, you're the only woman in my life. You're number one. You're all that matters to me. There are concubines and queens and virgins all over the place that I could have at any time. But you, you alone are mine. And what he does is reassure her that he is still infatuated. And he reassures her that she is the only woman in his life. And there's only one last thing to do then. As you see this little spat unfold in front of you, and you see how they handled it. You see how they take initiative, how they go out, they cry for help as they seek and call, as they respond and see the beauty of each other again. There's only one last principle that needs to be remembered. We need to be reasonable, reaching, remembering, respecting, and reassuring, not holding grudges, not holding things against people. But notice the last principle. Verse 11 through 13, and by the way, verse 11 has been considered by some the toughest verse in the whole Book of Song of Songs. I don't think that's true personally, but many people have said that. I went down to the Garden of Nuts to see the verdure of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded and the pomegranate had bloomed. Before I was even aware, my soul had made me as the chariots of my noble people. Return, O Shulamite, return, O return, that we may look upon you. What would you see in a Shulamite, as it were, the dance of the two camps? As you read those verses, you recognize that she is saying this. You know, I went down to the garden. Remember I talked about the garden? Remember I told you my lover was at the garden? I knew he'd be there. I knew he'd be carrying on his regular work. And that's where I went. That's where I found him. And I went down there. And before I knew it, before I could even get things worked out, I was right back to where I used to be with my love. I was back in the 57 Chevy, and we were driving down the road. I was back in the royal chariot before I even could think about it, before I even knew what happened. We were reconciled and things were back to normal. In fact, my beloved said to me, return, return, O Shulamite, return, return. And I said, why would you want me? And you recognize in those verses, it just stacks up when they finally met. He said, man, are you the love of my life? The only love of my life. And she said, before I even knew what happened, before I had to explain and ask forgiveness or apologize or any of that nonsense, he took me in. We were totally reconciled. And he says, come, 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 with urgency on his lips when he saw me come. And he says, return. And immediately I thought, why would he want me? Why in the world would he want me, a Shulamite? And you recognize that this sixth principle is this: be reconciling. Just open your arms and let them walk back. When they see you and when you see them, you don't need to apologize and explain and ask all the forgiveness and take care of all the details. And I'm not taking you back until I explain to you once more, whatever. He just says, you're the love of my life. She said, I couldn't believe it. We were totally back together. We were totally restored. We were totally reconciled before I could even think about it. Before we even had one explanation or apology or forgiveness. Because I'm my beloved's and my beloved is mine. We have a relationship that is so solid. And we have silly little fights. Those little moments when I was thinking about myself and asked some things that probably were a little selfish. And she was probably thinking about herself and responded in a way that was just kind of thinking of herself. Those moments when we could have easily got out of whack and it gone worse and worse and worse as we tried to retaliate and seek revenge and get even and you're not doing that again and all those other things. Before we knew it was all over. You recognize, if I got the chronology right, it started early in the morning when he came back from a deacon's meeting or hunting or whatever it was, and it ended before the morning really was over. It was all done. Everything was back to normal. Life was back to where it should be and could be. And I suspect that although some people have suggested Song of Songs is just an idealistic drama that never in a million years could happen, there's no husband and wife who possibly could ever live like this. I do take it that this really happened. there really was a man named Solomon. He really did have a wife, the Shulamite. They really did get married. They really did struggle one night. A silly little fight that could have driven them apart, but it did not. Here's the principles. Be reasonable. Don't rush or retaliate. Don't force the door open. Leave Chanel number 5 and say, maybe it is a little unreasonable to expect her to get out of bed at 5 in the morning. Be reaching. Do not hold on to your pride, but take the initiative. Pay the price. Call for help. Do whatever it takes. This is a relationship we need to restore. Be remembering. Think about the wonder of what you have, not the wonder of what you're going to have if we get rid of him or get rid of her. Remember what you have. You got the cream of the crop. Be respecting. Do not doubt what he's doing. Don't doubt his loyalty or his love. Don't assume that everything's going bad when maybe it's going well. Be reassuring as they go back and forth from the woman to the man. Don't hold a grudge. And finally, be reconciling. Make sure it was a silly little fight. He probably was a little selfish. He probably did ask for something he probably didn't have any right to ask for. But let's just get past it. Let's just move on. Let's get it over with. Perhaps the greatest verse in that section is that one right in the middle where she says, I am my beloved and my beloved is mine. When they, the daughters of Jerusalem, looking on, challenge her. Well, where'd he go? What's so great about your guy? She says, you know, when I think about it, I don't ever question his love or his loyalty to me. You have a wonderful marriage when you never suspect, you never wonder, you never question. You're just absolutely, totally, 100% confident. I am my beloved's and he's mine. And we have spats once in a while. And sometimes I ask him stupid things and sometimes she does some stupid things. But there's no question in our mind. This one's going on forever. I trust that as we study that, it's a wonderful, wonderful truth. It could be used. Some of those principles, I think, can be used in other relationships that you have besides your spouse. In conflict areas with family members or people at work or whatever, I think a lot of those things might be important for you to think through as well. But here, it helps you and me to recognize what a wonderful thing it is. Now, if this song really has a double meaning, that it's talking about a man and a woman and the love they have for themselves, for each other, I should say. But beyond that, it helps us understand what it's like to be the bride of Christ and for him to be my bridegroom. Imagine this statement, to wake up every morning with this truth. I'm my beloved's and he's mine. I never have to worry about my relationship to the Lord Jesus Christ. I never have to worry about whether he loves me or not. Oh, once in a while I do some silly little thing that really hurts him. But I know he'll always be there. I know he will always love me. And I trust I will always love him. It is a wonderful relationship that we have with Christ. And I trust we can have and work at and develop in our marriages as well. You might say, well, not every marriage is like that. And you'd be correct. And we understand it takes two to tango. And sometimes one person can be almost 100% right in everything they're doing. And the spouse just does whatever they do. But we understand that God has to lift for us this ideal and say, this is possible. And this is the marriage you want. This is the marriage you work for. Because what a wonderful privilege it is to wake up every morning and say, I am my beloved's. He's mine. End of discussion. I know he'll be there. I trust him.